Broadcasting from the Co-Certified Studios in beautiful downtown Burbank, this is National Bugle Radio.
Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Fantastic, fabulous, fun, philosophical Friday. And it is early, pre-dawn. Is it pre-dawn? Well, it's past midnight. It is Wednesday a.m. So it's not Friday.
Good morning.
Good morning, Philbert, with Philbert. And so we're going to talk about some stuff today. And Philbert, you know what I'd like to start off talking about?
Ringtones?
Ringtones? Well, what kind of ringtone do I have?
An Asian sounding ringtone.
It's just a standard one that comes with Samsung, but maybe it is Asian sounding, I don't know.
But I guess that would explain it.
That would explain it, yeah. And sometimes people hear my ringtones because sometimes I forget to turn off my phone during the middle of the show, and people call. You know, it happens. It happens from time to time. Sometimes I have to take the call. It depends. Depends who's calling. Anyway, I don't think anybody's going to be calling me now because of the hour, the late hour. But I wanted to talk about Tulsi Gabbard, who is a congresswoman from Hawaii. You are somewhat familiar with whom I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, 37 years old.
Yes, and very beautiful. And she is going to announce this week that she's running for president, apparently, in the Democratic primaries. Now, she's getting a lot of grief. She's been getting a lot of grief. And the grief is a little bit interesting, and it's a little bit personal. So the Daily Stormer has been reporting that no sooner had she indicated that she was intending to run, I guess she was on CNN program by this black guy named, he's got like a big bald head, you know the one I'm talking about.
You have glasses too?
He has like wire rim glasses. They all
have glasses. Yeah, otherwise they just look like they needed to be pushing a broom.
He's a big guy. He's kind of big, and he was had a minor role for about a year in the Obama administration, but he got pushed out actually because he had signed some sort of 9-1-1 truth petition. So he was kind of a doubter in the story of 9-1-1. But on CNN, what's the guy's name? He's got kind of like, he's a little bit like beady-eyed and, hold on a second. Van Jones, that's it, Van Jones. Yeah, he was a green energy official, kind of a minor character in the Obama administration, and now he's got his own show on CNN. I've only seen like tiny bits of it because I don't really like him. He was on a lot of panels during the 2016 election. He's very anti-Trump and very predictable, progressive. But at any rate, I guess she had been a guest on his show, and he didn't get the memo that he wasn't supposed to like her, because the Jews don't like her. And no sooner had she indicated that she was intending on announcing her candidacy in the Democratic primaries than the entire, you know, Jewish Twitter world came out against her, and they're talking about, oh, well, she met with Assad and
did she meet with Putin too?
I don't know if she met with Putin. But here's one of the big criticisms they have of her is that David Duke had endorsed her as Secretary of State. I mean, it's and Tucker's show tonight, he was talking about that. And, you know, they're all against it. And he mentioned the Daily Beast, which is, I guess, the new incarnation of Time, or Newsweek magazine, one or the other. And, you know, the Daily Beast was saying how awful she was, and she's just like David Duke. And I looked at the Daily Beast article, and it was referring to an article from David Duke's blog. And, of course, it was actually me who had endorsed her for Secretary of State. Although...
Look at you go.
I know. I felt really... Like, in a way, I felt really good about it, but it's causing her grief. I like her. And I think I've probably been the main promoter of hers on the so-called alt-right, although certainly the first, although Eric Stryker has also been an early promoter, and we did a show in 2016, the two of us, where we were promoting her in November 2016, and also in November 2016, I think even prior to that, Mark Dankoff and I did a show promoting her. So certainly Mark Dankoff and myself and Eric Stryker have been promoting her since November 2016 because of her position on Middle East wars, which is about as good of a position as you can expect from anybody in the political establishment. And it's spread. And I guess Richard Spencer has said good things about her, and now Andrew Anglin has declared her the official Democratic candidate of the alt-right. So it's kind of fun. And, you know, I don't mind that they are conflating my article with Dr. Duke. It's fine because Dr. Duke came out, like, the article that they referred to was written by me. But Dr. Duke wrote his own article, a few weeks afterwards, also promoting her. So, but it was me that introduced, not literally introduced her to him, but, you know, I'm the one who had informed Dr. Duke of Tulsi Gabbard and her positions. And, of course, in a lot of ways, she's a progressive Democrat, but she's a progressive Democrat who has had to apologize for her early career being an activist against gay marriage, for instance.
Oh.
So.
Hawaii, huh?
Hawaii. Now.
Wasn't that one of the first places gay marriage was, or same-sex unions were
It was. It was. It was one of the first places. And her father, who was a state representative, was one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the campaign to stop it. And that's how she got her political start.
Huh.
So, now, she's often referred to as like a, you know, the Mike Enoch and the TRS people are always referring to her as by some derogatory term for Indians, and of course she's not doesn't have a drop of Indian blood. Her first name Tulsi, that is a Hindu name because her mother was some sort of hippie Hare Krishna type, but her mother was 100 from what I can tell was 100% of English ancestry, and her father seems to be of 3/4 English and 1/4 Samoan ancestry, so she's like 1/8 Samoan, and then 7/8 Anglo-Saxon. And so it gets kind of weird to hear Mike Enoch, who, from what I can tell, doesn't have a drop of Anglo-Saxon blood, pulling the whiter than thou on her. But whatever, it's kind of funny. I don't really care about these things, but it can be kind of funny. Who's pulling whitey on whom? Who's got the white priority? And I don't know. I mean, we don't really talk like this. You know, I mentioned Professor Stephen F. Cohen from time to time, and he was once on a panel at some Jewish forum where who's that lady? Julia Yaffe, who. Is she with the Washington Post now? I'm not sure who she's with now. I think she used to be with the Post. And she's some very young woman born in Russia, Jew, who was able to come here because of all of the Jewish privilege in our immigration law. She was able to come here And of course, because she's Jewish, she's more American than we are, even though she wasn't born here.
Yeah.
And, you know, has all the privilege, and she's able
to... Didn't Obama say something like, if you're not Native American Indian, then you can't have a say in who comes here?
He probably said something like that.
I think I do remember him saying that.
Yeah, that sounds like the type of thing.
And I thought, then why don't we go ask the Indians if they want all these foreigners coming in, or
I'm sure they love having Somalis come over.
Maybe you could ask the Indians if we think we should be sending, you know, all that money to Israel's, you know, military aid and monetary aid or whatever it is.
It makes no sense, and you know.
Anyway,
I bet if you actually went to half of the blacks on the street and asked them what they thought about massive immigration to the United States, you know, I don't know how they get their polling data, but how many blacks are really in favor of having a whole bunch of foreigners come over? But anyway, getting back to what I was talking about, but yeah, getting back to Tulsi Gabbard, and recently, of course, I was suggesting that she should be the Secretary of Defense. And it's not that I think people with a military background, only people with a military background should be Secretary of Defense, but she does have a military background. And it's not like I really promote having women in the military, especially, like, I think if Tulsi Gabbard was in a company or a platoon or whatever, it would create a lot of havoc because, you know, because she's hot. And, you know, I don't think that would really be good for morale. I don't think having women in those situations is necessarily going to be good for morale, because there's not going to be enough to go around, and people got to stay focused. But at any rate.
Yeah, I agree.
But to have her in the Pentagon, fine. To have her as Secretary of Defense, fine. Have her in a combat unit, not so much. You know? That's my personal opinion.
Wasn't it Mr. Bill Clinton that introduced that or got that going with the women in the military?
He was the gay, like the don't ask, don't tell gays in the military. I don't know. Like, I mean, there've been women in the military for a long time. Of course, in World War II, you had the waves were the women's naval whatever, and the WACs were the women's air corps, and I don't know what they called the women in the army. They each had their own, you know, moniker.
But I feel in an ideal society, we should have men in the military, but, you know, whatever. It is
they
what
were
it
mostly
is.
Nurses I, and like that. They weren't in, you know, regular, not just combat, but they weren't in, you know, support, supply chain. They weren't in that. And that's something that's come gradually. But at any rate, yeah, so we've certainly promoted her. Now, when Tucker... so here's the thing. So she's had to try to, you know, repudiate Dr. Duke's endorsement of her. And, you know, she tweeted out something like, well, by the way, her own father wouldn't have been allowed in a whites-only... establishment or something like that. Well, you know, they didn't have whites-only establishments in Hawaii when her father was younger. And I've seen pictures of her father. He's, you know, he's a quarter Samoan. And so he looks like he's a little bit part something. She really doesn't look like she's part anything. She just looks like a white lady, and a very nice-looking white lady at that. But you know, in the context of Hawaii, I don't know if you've ever been there, but...
I have not.
Yeah, I mean, in Hawaii, you don't really want to be white, but you can get away because white people get beat up.
You don't want to live there, I've heard. It's okay to be a tourist.
Yeah, or if you live there, there's certain things you have to know. But
I've heard the homeless, there's lots of homeless down there. It's like really crazy.
Yeah, but it's not a bad place to be homeless. I knew a guy who was homeless.
Oh, yeah, I could imagine. Didn't California ship them out there in boats because they know they won't come back?
Oh, that's a nice place. And I knew a guy who lived in a cave. He was a Hawaiian caveman. There was a cave behind there's some caves behind the University of Hawaii, and he used to, you know, go back up there, and he had a sleeping bag, and he'd sleep up there, and then he'd go down to the beach, and, you know, there were public showers at the beach, and it just wasn't a bad place to be homeless. And I think there's a lot of homeless people in Hawaii, because it's not bad. It's very mild weather. But anyway, that's another thing. So apparently, not just Van Jones, but also this other black guy who's on Tucker's show, his name's like Professor Jason Williams or something like that. He's a black studies professor at the University of Maryland, and he smiles, and he's got, you know, a nice smile, and he's friendly with Tucker. He's not obnoxious. Doesn't really seem to be that smart. You know, he's not stupid, but he doesn't really seem to be that smart. I've looked at his Rate My Professor page, and he's actually reasonably popular with his students, so, you know, whatever. But he had been talking, like, kind of floating the idea of Tulsi Gabbard for president. I don't know what's going to happen. And the thing is, in a field of, you know, it could be 20 people running. In a field of 20 people, to have one single solitary person who is supporting the more traditional Democratic position of not going around fighting wars everywhere, which used to be a Democratic position, or at least it used to have a big following in the Democratic Party, in the tradition of Eugene McCarthy or George McGovern or, you know, I guess Fred Harris and others. That used to be kind of a thing. Is there still a constituency for somebody who doesn't want to fight wars everywhere? And if there is such a constituent, and I think there is, because I think a lot of the people who voted for Bernie Sanders mistakenly thought that was, you know, Bernie Sanders was an anti-war person, which he was not. But, you know, that was, but I think a lot of the voters supporting him would. I think she could pick up a lot of that, and in such a crowded field, anybody with a, you know, like a reasonable hunk of the electorate is going to go far. So we'll see. It's kind of interesting. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to create problems for her by having probably more than anyone else been the person responsible for making her into the, you know, the alt-rights or the traditional, what is it, like, you know, the white nationalist favorite for Democratic nominee. But, you know, I don't want to cause trouble for her. But the thing is, I had written my article, and it was quoted. The title of it was quoted, or at least the, you know, the word realignment was quoted. The article I wrote in November 2016 was saying, why shouldn't there be a realignment of politics? Because there are people, even if there aren't leaders, really, in the Democratic Party who support non-intervention or, you know, more peaceful foreign policy, there are certainly voters. And I think lots of people who voted for Bernie Sanders voted for him due to a misunderstanding about his position. And I think she could pick up a lot of this support. But really, what ought to happen is she ought to leave. What I'd like to see is her get enough of a following in the primaries and then leave the party and hopefully pull a lot of the party over to an alliance with Trump, and I'd like to see a lot of the Republicans leave, you know, the neocons leave, and they can join the Democrats, and you have a political realignment. That's really what I'd like to see. So, what do you think of that, Philbert?
That's a lot to take in.
I know.
I've been pretty black pill lately, so.
Well, let's get to the black pilling on the other side of the break, then.
Okay.
So the music is going to start in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Half. Thank you.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anybody who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future. Welcome back to the show. Well, this is the part of the show where Philbert gets to tell me what he's been blackpilled about recently.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you this. I was thinking about this earlier today, or maybe last week sometime. Who knows? But you know how affirmative action has kind of ruined a lot of people's workforce in general. And Florida just did the law where they released a whole bunch of felons. No, they let felons vote. I'm sorry.
And it's amazing how many, what is it, 850,000 or something?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's this huge amount. How many felons do they have? Or is it in the millions? Was it 1.6 million? What was it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, actually, yeah, more than 1 million, according to NPR and other sources. And just think of it. I mean, the 2000 election, which swung on Florida, The vote difference between Bush and Gore was like less than 600, and in these two, in the senatorial election and the gubernatorial election last November, the difference in votes was just maybe a few tens of thousands, and now you're talking about a million. So that would certainly swing. That would have swung, and that would have been enough to swing the vote for Hillary too in 2016. So. That is a black pill.
So with the increasing number of, you know, low skill, high testosterone, low impulse control refugees that are coming in, a lot of these people are going to become felons. And, you know, I just see the workforce degrading. And this may be happening already, but I got to thinking that eventually, like, almost every single company may have something akin to affirmative action where you have to have X amount of felons on staff.
Well, yeah. And
I don't, have you ever heard of that happening? Is that already happening?
That is one of the demands of Black Lives Matter.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
If you go to Black Lives Matter's website, and it's really weird, and it's, you know, Black Lives Matter is not an organization organic to the black community. It's something that was parachuted into it. Like, okay, maybe it was these two black lesbians who had come up with the hashtag Black Lives Matter, but the organization itself is parachuted in, largely sponsored by, you know, George Soros and other Jewish money. And when you looked at, if you go to blacklivesmatter.org or whatever it is, and you look at their manifesto, at least if you did this a year or two ago, it was all about, you know, blacks, all kinds of black folks, including undocumented worker black folks, you know, illegal alien black folks, queer black folks, transgender black folks.
As long as you're not white.
Yeah, black folks with criminal records, you know, and all these black folks, aren't we all matter? And yeah, so they were really pushing the, black folks with records as a, you know, another victim class. Yeah, so I haven't heard about that per se, but I do know that there's been legislation in some states. I think states, or at least in, I'm pretty sure the city of Philadelphia, I could be mistaken on which place it is, but I know there has been this kind of legislation that bans employers from asking questions about criminal records. And, you know, the thing is, we're getting to this weird situation where you must ask questions in many cases. Either you have to ask questions or you have to get formal, you know, state-mandated security, sexual offender certification, right? That you have to certify that you're not a sexual offender. So in certain types of crimes, you're mandated, you have to ask, but increasingly other types of crimes you're not allowed to ask. It's very, very, very odd there.
So whenever they ask a race, whenever I'm filling out an application, I always put that I'm black, African American.
Do you?
Because, yeah, I do. And the reason is because if you have X amount of number of workers, the federal government says you have to have so many non-whites. I don't know what that number is. But, you know, if you can throw off the data, why wouldn't you? You
know? Yeah, you always should. I know that, for instance, if you were applying for a federal grant, if you are running a nonprofit, things like that, you have to report how many non-whites and women that you have on your board, you know, your board of directors.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, you have to. And now California, this past November, passed a law that mandates that corporations, I guess it would only be corporations that are domiciled in California, but they must have at least one female one female board member.
So let me ask you this. The way I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the federal government is the biggest participator in affirmative action. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe so. You look at the, you know, the post office, which is massively disproportionately black. And then if you go around Washington, D.C., you know, the top jobs...
TSA.
Well, the TSA, yeah. And a lot of the top jobs in the federal government are not going to go to blacks because they just don't have the qualifications. But the lower-level jobs, you know, and middle-level jobs are disproportionately black. We have to go off to the break. We'll be right back.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anybody who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
And we are back. And Philbert, you mentioned the TSA as a possible source of affirmative action workers. Now, this is just hearsay, and it is hearsay from Mike Enoch on the Tedious show. It's very tedious. But he was saying that he traveled recently. And, of course, there have been some anecdotal reports that that TSA employees are reporting for, they're reporting sick. They're calling in sick since the government shutdown at twice the normal rate. Well, at twice the normal rate, really, for a healthy workplace, instead of having 1% of the people out sick, you'd have 2% out. Because really, I mean, I know people who, if they get 5 sick days per year, are going to make sure they take every single one. I never did that. I think I have called in sick maybe 2 or 3 times in my entire life. But that's just me. But still, I mean...
You're a good goy.
I am a good goy. But if you have 250 work days a year, and even somebody maxing out, if they get 5 sick days, I don't know how many sick days people typically get, but if you get 5 sick days or something, and you're maxing out, you would only be missing 2% of your work days. And most, I don't think most people do that. I think most people just go to work. I could be wrong. Maybe public sector employees are different or whatever.
I guess it depends on the kind of looks you get from your boss when you come back.
Yeah. It's just not something I've done. And even as a kid, I often had perfect attendance going to school.
Oh, you're such a good goy.
Not that I was even that good of a student, but I would go to school. A few times I stayed home. I do remember a few times staying home and watching Jeopardy on TV and whatnot. It was pretty boring, though.
Philbert got an attendance award in high school, too. Didn't miss one day.
Yeah, my senior year, I didn't miss a single day. Now, I missed a lot of classes. I'd be skipping class in school or whatever. But but anyway, that's another story. So the thing is, really, how much of a difference should it make if you went from 1% to 2%? But getting back to Mike Enoch's, his anecdote is that he was traveling and he saw just very, very white TSA employees insinuating that those who are calling in sick are the black ones. I don't know if there's anything to that or not. But
so how did the federal government become the biggest participant of this affirmative action? I mean, I know who did it in triple parentheses, but I mean, I don't fully... When did this happen? Was this under Clinton?
No, it was under...
go further back?
No, President Johnson. President Johnson in the 1960s. It started in the 1960s. And it was in high gear in the 1970s. It was already in high gear in the 1970s. It was very difficult for a white man in, mid-1970s, even early 1970s, to get a job in Washington, D.C., in the government. It was already difficult by then. This goes back to the 70s, and it's been institutionalized for a long time. There's been a long history of discrimination. And here's the thing, with the government shutdown, you're hearing all of these reports. I watch the NPR, not the NPR, the PBS NewsHour, and they keep playing up all of these federal workers who live paycheck to paycheck. Look, federal workers get a lot of money. So the only...
Well, they get a lot of gimme dads.
Now, granted, rents in Washington, D.C. area can be high, but still, they get...
They're going to have to sell them spinners.
But the thing, the idea that they shouldn't have... I mean, they should have savings. They should have savings. They shouldn't be living paycheck to paycheck. But you know who lives paycheck to paycheck is...
A lot of veterans.
People with poor impulse control, people with high time preference who are going to, if people. I had somebody recently who was complaining about her banker. Her banker was alarmed that she was withdrawing so much of her retirement savings, and she just told me, "Look, I got to deal with today's problems today. I don't got time to worry about tomorrow." You know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, I know what you mean. That actually explains a lot. So, why would these people, why would you be hearing about federal workers living paycheck to paycheck or not having any savings? And, you know, now they're missing a week of pay, and suddenly, you know, they don't have money for food. I mean, that makes no sense, because federal workers are paid very well.
Hey, speaking of that, it just reminded me, I saw a little news blip where Kraft Heinz is offering free food to federal workers who are run out of food.
I hope, yeah. And maybe it's a lot of grape drink, too.
I mean, I think that says more about Kraft Heinz than it does the federal government.
Yeah. I said great drink. I don't know what else. I shouldn't talk like this, really, because I don't want to sound, you know, all racist and all. But, and I only say it because having been a white man for all my life, I endured years and years and years of anti-white rhetoric and everything, and I endured it well. But I did reach a breaking point, and I'm sick of it now. And
did you break his arm? I'm just joking.
No, so I was thinking, okay, what would be the cliches? I mean, I know maybe Schlitz 45 malt liquor, or is that what it's called? No, Colt 45 malt liquor. Is that what it is? And Newport, Newport cigarettes and grape drink. But cool. I was thinking, well, what do they eat? I don't know. What would be a stereotypical thing? I mean, you know, there's
fried obvious, chicken.
Well, there's fried chicken. Yeah, I guess Popeye's chicken, you know.
Watermelon?
I like watermelon. I eat so much watermelon, Philbert, that I average it out so that you can't make blacks into like watermelon eaters, because I eat so much. So the whites on average, if you include me, I might be an outlier, but I eat an awful lot of watermelon.
I like apples.
Yeah, I buy them by the bag. Well, and it reminded me, I was watching years ago an episode of Upstairs Downstairs, which is a British drama. Are you familiar with Upstairs Downstairs?
No, I'm not. How old is it?
It was made in the early 1970s, maybe late 60s, but I think early 1970s. It was very well done, and it chronicled a fictional upper class British family. The wife was of money, and the husband was not of money, but he married into money and became a politician. He didn't really have his own money, and then they had a family. And it started in, I think, 1905, and it ended with the Great Depression, and the scion of the family, the son who had inherited the mother's money, losing all his money because he had gone over to America and got involved with Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs invested all his money in such a way that he lost every penny of it, and then he stuck a gun in his mouth and blew his brains out, and that was the next to the last show. And then the show ended with his cousin, whose marriage he was supposed to pay for. Well, he couldn't pay for the marriage because Goldman Sachs lost all his money and he blew his brains out. But the cousin got married anyway. And that was the end of it. But there was one episode which took place in maybe the early 1920s. It was post-World War I. And the cousin, who he was a flapper, she had invited over all her friends, and even invited over an American jazz band, which was Negro musicians. And when the Cockney cook found out that there were going to be Negroes coming over to the house, like, she was kind of appalled, and she thought, well, what am I supposed to cook for them? What do they eat? Do they eat the same kind of food we do. And so that just, why am I talking about this? I don't know. But this is what crossed my mind when I was
kind of funny.
You know, when I was trying to think of something to go along with Grape Drink, what Kraft might be donating to the furloughed federal workers. But yeah, and so here's the thing. We've had affirmative action, which was originally for blacks, but it's been expanded. You know, it was expanded really to women. It's expanded to Hispanics, which I can't figure out why. You know, because the vast majority of Hispanics are post-1965. What do they have? I mean, what is the rationale for... For blacks, the rationale is there was a historical injustice done to them, even if it was, you know, two centuries ago. There was some historical injustice. And but with you know, a Guatemalan, what's the historical injustice that whites need to sacrifice, you know, their children's seat in a university and give it to a Hispanic? I remember seeing a Mexican girl who was, she wasn't even the valedictorian, but she was allowed to address the graduating class of her university, and she was bragging about her work browning the university. And why is that supposed to be a clap line? Why are the, you know, the white parents who actually paid for their kids to go to the school supposed to clap for a, you know, a Mexican girl whose education was completely subsidized by, you know, their kids' massively overpriced tuition?
Probably because the applause light was on.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's it, right? It's social confirmation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they run the media, again, in triple parentheses.
Yes. The echoes. I hear the echoes. And so, you know, these people who, you know, want to welcome foreigners over here, you know, it would be one thing if the foreigners were coming to be Americans, but they're not coming to be Americans.
That's just not how it works.
It's not how it works. And, you know, they're coming to displace Americans. And
I mean, even if they were honestly fleeing, like, you know, an asteroid or something, you know, reasonable, they tried to be Americans. They still couldn't. Like, you know, even if you wanted to help them, I mean, you couldn't expect somebody, you know, to lose your identity, especially, you know, when they pretty much have an ethnostate.
Yeah, but what's being asked of us, and it's not sincere. But what's being asked, you know, the narrative is, well, look, you just have to make certain sacrifices for them, and then eventually they're going to be like you. So yeah, just accept, you know, it's not really anti-white discrimination. It's affirmative action, and they might not be as qualified when they enter the school, but they'll be just as good when they come out of the school. That was a narrative for a while. They'll be just as good when they come out. And of course they're not. You know, they remain lower qualified, and we're supposed to, you know, sacrifice our positions, let our kids be passed over in terms of admissions to universities, which is a big deal. Or, you know, entry-level jobs or promotions once you're in jobs. And we're supposed to accept being second-class citizens. And it's permanent because it's been going on for 50 years. I mean, you asked me about the affirmative action. President Johnson hasn't been president for 50 years. This has become permanent. And there's no end in sight.
Yeah, it's pretty much white genocide. I mean, it's replacement. I mean, white genocide is replacement level migration from non-whites alone, right? I mean, isn't that the definition of it? I mean, there's several definitions of it, but
well, there is,
I believe the UN defines it under replacing a non-native population with another population, I believe.
Well, you know, it is
probably. Doing really bad at explaining.
No, I believe it's the third Geneva Convention or the fourth Geneva Convention, one of them, which outlaws, for instance, an occupying army or an occupying country from moving its from moving a civilian population into the occupied country. Now, if you were to understand the United States as being an occupied country, Zionist-occupied America, you know, ZOG, which is how we understand it, then absolutely, they're moving in a civilian population. That is absolutely a war crime. In terms of genocide, and thanks to the miracle of the internet, I've been able to pull up this UN convention. It's the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1946. And in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical,
racial,
yes, or religious group as such. Okay, it could be A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Mental harm. I mean, we've got the mental harm, for instance, with the
all of the above,
the opioid crisis and all. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Okay, and you know, really, conditions of life. Feminism has done that. Conditions of life, the economic conditions that make us postpone, childbirth, or, you know, basically we're getting enforced gayness. But it gets better.
I like this next one.
Yes,
too.
Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group.
I talked about that last week.
Yeah, now, obviously you could talk about abortion. That could go in there, but honestly, there's more abortions, much higher rates of abortions among blacks and Hispanics. Now, part of the reason they have higher rates of abortion is because they have so many more pregnancies. White women aren't getting pregnant, especially not with white men. And then here's one, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group.
Public schools?
Yeah, Don Advil talks about turning, white children basically into the chattel for blacks in public schools. But deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And I think that's where you put the massive immigration of a different group. And that is going to bring about...
There is clear evidence of it, changing our racial makeup. I don't know how it could get any more obvious.
And you see this, but I want to make sure we don't come up against the next break. We are up against the next break. Thank you. And we are back. But you know, Philbert, I've always really avoided using the term white genocide. And it's not that I don't think you can make a case for it. I think you can make a case. And, you know, I've had Andy Hitchcock on, and he's written a lot about white genocide. And you can certainly make the legal case for it. But the problem with making the legal case for it is it gets legalistic, and you have to pull up this UN Convention on Genocide, and you have to say, well, what constitutes what? Whereas if you say replacement, you know, they're trying to replace us, that's a lot easier. And I think it, you know, it doesn't have the shock value, but, you know, the shock value can make it harder to accept. And I think if you're able to make the case that they are trying to replace us, that's enough. I think that's enough to get people on our side, and I think it's more effective. So I like the term replacement better than genocide. And I'm not saying it's not because genocide's not happening.
Right.
But I think it's more effective.
Sometimes I think we're too nice, but, you know, I'm not a political strategist. I wouldn't be any good at it. I'm just a dude that plays guitar and drums.
Do you have any new projects?
I do.
What's going on?
Well, I'm working on a cover, and I don't want to give it away, but it's from the 80s, and it's like it's not a hard rock song, so.
I remember the 80s.
Yeah.
Is there anything I might know?
Well, I'm sure you do.
Okay. Well, we are coming up towards the end. I just want to remind people that as soon as we find a venue in Hollywood big enough, we are going to hold the first annual Goyim's Choice Awards, and you're going to like it, and it's going to be a gala affair, and we're going to have people from all over the world. It's going to be big, and it's just a matter of securing a venue big enough. Okay, well, I think I'm hearing our swan song, so we'll be back again soon. Thank you for coming on, Philbert.
Oh, pleasure as always.
All right, and and I have coming up on tomorrow, it's going to be Mark Dankoff, and Friday I've got a special interview with Monica Schaefer, who was a former political prisoner in Germany, and Patrick Little, who is interesting as always. So those will be the next exciting episodes of National Bugle Radio.